Topic this morning is this: is theistic evolution a viable option for the biblical Christian? So I present Dr. David Menon.
Thank you. The answer is no. Are there any questions? Let's go right for the jugular. I know what this building was meant for here, that this was actually designed and laid out for young pastors and teachers to teach them something about eye contact when talking to a group of people. If I get dizzy and fall down swinging my head back and forth here, bear with me. Well, I first of all want to thank Dr. Klotz for that introduction. I've known John a long time. Actually, I've known him since 1955, to be exact, but I didn't know him personally then. It was about then or shortly thereafter that I got his book, Genes, Genesis, and Evolution. I was just a whippersnapper in high school last year and destined for a career in science and didn't know what lay ahead of me at all. I needed all the help I could get, and I had already read a couple of years earlier sainted Professor Braywinkle's book on the flood. And those two books, perhaps as much as anything, I think put me in good stead to face the world as it came later. That together, of course, with God's Word. And what I really wanted to talk to you today about is something about what young people go through when they face the world of science. I'll be talking about the views of certain scientists who are very distinguished, and I know their views aren't necessarily that of everyone else, but nonetheless, I think I'm reasonably fairly representing the evolutionary paradigm and the creationist view of things. I was told by David Peter we'd meet at the Luther statue, so I thought, how would Luther begin this talk if he were going to do it? And I dug into my table talks, which are full of all sorts of comments about everything. I thought this would be as good a kickoff as any. The best argument there is a God, and it often moved me deeply, is this one, that he proves from generation of species, a cow always bears a cow, a horse always bears a horse, etc. No cow gives birth to a horse. No horse gives birth to a cow. No goldfish produces a siskin. Therefore, it is necessary to conclude that there is something that directs everything thus. And thus said Martin Luther. I have to wonder what he would think about today were he to pick up an issue of Scientific American or something like that and see that today it is widely assumed in the evolutionary community that the whales evolved from the bovidae, which are cows, basically, the cattle. They don't give us a lot of detail how this happened. Some people have tried to imagine what this might look like, you know, the cow wandering deeper and deeper into the water. I must confess my own imagination runs short to really put this all together. Charles Darwin seemed to have no trouble with this kind of imagination. Let me quote from the first edition of Darwin's Origin of Species. He said, "I can see no difficulty in a race of bears being rendered by natural selection more and more aquatic in their habitats with larger and larger mouths till a creature was produced as monstrous as a whale." Darwin had no trouble with this. Of course, Darwin had no formal training in science whatever, so possibly he had an easier time of it. Unfortunately, many can imagine this today, apparently, who have a formal training in science, and that perhaps is a bit of a question we can touch on later. Mercifully, Darwin took this comment out of The Origin of Species after the first edition, and it doesn't appear after that. I guess any talk like this should begin with just what on earth is science, if we're going to worry about our origins from a scientific point of view. I don't want to say a lot about it, because I know Dr. Klotz has probably chatted with most of you about the subject. I would simply remind you that when we say that evolution is not science, as often creationists do, or evolutionists often say, creation is not science. They're both right in a very important sense of the word. They're right because usually when we think of science, and certainly the way the great scientists of the past defined science, we were talking about empirical science, which means science which rests on observation. It must deal with repeatable phenomena, events that can be looked at again and again, events which can be measured, events which can be observed, or their effects can be observed. That's empirical science, and it's true, neither creation or evolution, in my view, really measures up to that kind of science. No one has ever run evolution through again. We haven't said, would you run that whale through one more time for us? We want to see just exactly how that cow cow-like ancestor, it would never be a cow, it would always have to be a cow-like ancestor. That takes some of the edge off, you know. We didn't come from apes, we came from ape-like ancestors. They look like an ape, they smell like an ape, they walk like an ape. But if you say apes, as Darwin did, by the way, not ape-like, then it sounds a little rougher. But science, when it tries to ask the question of not how does a hand work, you know, we can look. That's empirical science. How does it work? It's damaged. How can we fix it? When science asks how do we come to have hands in the first place, then they're obliged to make bricks without very much straw. They're obliged to get into a special realm of science, which has been debated endlessly among the philosophers of science, which is called historical science. Historical science deals, by definition, with non-repeatable, unique phenomena. And the origin of any biological specimen or component would certainly fall into that category. And so what sort of evidence is available to anyone, be he creationist or evolutionist, who looks at historical science? Two kinds of evidence, circumstantial evidence and analogy. We can try to understand what we see based on what we know here and now, and we can look for circumstantial evidence that may support or refute our views. How did the whole idea of evolution begin? Let me make one thing very, very clear. It did not begin in a laboratory. It did not begin with folks with white lab coats on and a great film badge of courage on their breast. No, I think it's probably, most of you know better than I do, we can certainly trace it back to the ancient Greeks. Empedocles and Aristotle, about 300-400 years B.C., had the whole concept in mind of nature producing a variety of organisms, many of which are unfit, and that these died off, and that there was a sort of a gradual transition from imperfect to perfect. That idea was pretty well known among philosophers 400 years before Christ. Epicurus, at around 300 B.C., was often considered the father of crass materialism, came up with a very important point, which I think is central to the whole issue we'll be discussing, and that is, he said, the universe is eternal. You needn't worry about who created the universe. It was not created. It has always been here. Today, very much the same sort of view is propounded or promoted by many evolutionists who would argue that matter and energy is eternal. It's always been here. It perhaps has cycled from some great compression to some great expansion and back to a compression into an expansion, much like Eastern mysticism. But the idea that it needn't be created, that it's always been here, is fundamental to the evolutionary view. Lucretius had that idea. Lucretius and other of the ancient Greeks came up with the idea that all human beings, everything, are made of little tiny particles, and of course you know what they called them, atoms. They called them atoms 300 years before Christ. And these little particles moved about, and that's really what we are. And then when we died, the little particles dissipated into space. And that all one had to do to account for origin was just to account for how these little particles would all sort of get together and how they'd all dissipate again. Huxley once defined evolution as the chaotic jazz dance of the molecules. I think a very interesting and I think appropriate definition. Nonetheless, Epicurus did come up with these ideas of the eternal universe, and he said that outside of this matter and energy, everything else was void. That sensation was the only source of knowledge. And he did all this for two reasons, I understand. One of the books I have on Lucretius also took the same view for two reasons. And that is that these views of everything being made out of sort of particles, matter, randomly assembled and dissipating into the universe on death, would emancipate man from two fears. the arbitrary interference of the gods in the affairs of men, and the fear of death, since there would be no existence of the soul after death would dissipate in the universe. I bring up this issue because I want to emphasize how important it is that the philosophical worldview that many people brought to these issues determined what they were willing to accept and what they were willing to see as they looked at nature. Moving on into New Testament times, I've often been intrigued. Did the apostles or anyone, perhaps Jesus himself, ever encounter evolution? Did Paul encounter evolution when he was on the Areopagus talking to all these philosophers who certainly were Epicurean Stoics? Well, he must have. He must have encountered something very much like it. The closest I can get to something a little bit more specific is the comment in Revelations regarding the churches at Ephesus and Pergamos, where they were criticized for having lost the first love. And interestingly, after talking about the loss of love, the Lord goes on to say, yet this you do have, that you hate. What a way to follow the first comment. We often get confused on what love is, I think, in the church. You shouldn't be harsh on anybody's views, right, if you love them. But this you do have, that you hate the deeds of the Nicolaitans, which I also hate. And this is repeated again later in Revelation, that you hate the Nicolaitans. That much you've got going for you. I've often wondered of you, what on earth were the deeds of the Nicolaitans to be so singled out for this sort of contempt? I don't know if it's true or not. I'm just throwing it out for your interest and perusal if you want to look into it. Unger's Bible Dictionary says the general voice of antiquity accuses the Nicolaitans of denying God to be the creator of the world and attributing its existence to other powers. I don't know. You folks will have to dig into that. Sounds reasonable in view of the sort of people that the Greeks were. Buffon came along a little later, about middle 1700s. He was a French naturalist. He greatly influenced geology, and he was the first to sort of take on the Bible directly, and yet in the name of Christianity. And he denied that there was such a thing as a universal flood, and he proposed that the days spoken of in Genesis were really great, long epics. And this was his attempt to try to pull together emerging geological views with biblical ones. De Maupertuis in 1750 wrote an essay called Essay de Cosmologie that dealt with blind destiny and chance. And there he said what I believe remains the basic axiom of evolution today. Chance, one might say, turned out a vast number of individuals. A small proportion of these were organized in such a manner that the animals' organs could satisfy their needs. A much greater number showed neither adaptation nor order. These last have all perished. Thus, the species that we see today are but a small part of those that blind destiny has produced. My friends, I would propose there really are only two views for origins. We've seen them emerge here in our discussion of the Greeks. Either the complexity we see about us in nature is as it is because nature does these things left to itself. It is intrinsic to the properties of matter, energy, time, and space to do this. Or the complexity that we see, not simply the order, the complexity in an informational sense, the complexity we see could be due to intentional design and purpose. As Christians, we would say God. That's true of everything. Now, you've heard the old example of a watch. I mean, carry it fairly well, but there's only two possibilities, fundamental possibilities for watches. Either nature does this thing left to itself. Matter has within it the intrinsic capability to self-organize and produce watches, probably via clockmakers. Okay? Or the watch reflects intentional and purposeful design. Now, there have been various combinations of those two views. Theistic evolution perhaps is an attempt to maybe pull in the best of both worlds. But you really can't think of a view that's totally outside of those two possibilities. Well, along from Darwin, Darwin was greatly influenced by Lamarck and Chambers and Buffon and the people we just mentioned. Darwin studied for the ministry, and he published his Origin of Species in 1859 after being on the voyage of the Beagle and thinking a great deal about what he had observed. Darwin attempted to account for what he had seen, the variation on the Galapagos, and the variation that he saw, particularly among animals under domestication, cows, chickens, pigeons, what have you. And he saw this range of variation, and he said, this range of variation is without limits. It just goes on and on and on. Darwin, I believe, was eagerly seeking for an explanation for origins that would not involve divine intervention. I'll make my point, I think, more firmly in a moment. But he saw in variation among selective breeding a model for what he felt could account for the origin of all living things. The example with the whale shows how unlimited his ability to perceive variation might be. He had four postulates, and these all fall in the realm of circumstantial evidence and are not predictions. They are circumstantial evidence based on what Darwin saw. One is variation, that individuals of the same species vary. There are over 150 different varieties of dogs, for example, and they all look quite different, from Chihuahuas to Great Danes. They vary much more than human beings do. Can you imagine running a clothing store if human beings varied as much as dogs? I mean, look at sleeve length alone. There is then, for each species, a certain range, a genetic latency, if you will, of variation. Darwin saw this. He saw how we could select for what we want. You want a dog with long hair, you'll get a dog with long hair. You want a dog with a long tail, you get a long tail. You want a dog with wings, you get a dog. No, I'm sorry, I went over. No, you won't get a dog with wings. You know why? Wings are not in the gene pool of the species anywhere. If you select for them, you're doomed. You're absolutely doomed. You'll not get it. But you want long hair, that you'll get. Permanent hair growth cycle. Hair will just keep growing like a poodle or a Yorkshire Terrier. So if it's in the genetic genome, you can select for it. And that's what Darwin observed. But Darwin knew nothing about genetics. I have to point this out. The creationist Gregor Mendel had discovered genetics somewhat earlier, but his information and ideas were lost in some rather obscure literature. And so Darwin had no concept of genetics on which to try to account for how you could get this sort of variation. And so he saw it as just continuous without limit, something we know better. Today. He said there's also overproduction, that is, there are more individuals born of many species than can survive, and so there is this struggle for existence. Well, he overlooked a few things there, too. Part of this production of excess individuals fits into the whole food chain. How many living organisms does a whale consume and sift out of the ocean per day? So one could say that those small microorganisms are an overproduction, and yet without them, the whale would not survive. But nonetheless, he saw this idea of overproduction having been influenced by the economic ideas of Malthus, and this nature is red in tooth and claw, kill or be killed, became a part of the whole axiom that he was developing. Within this then followed the survival of the fittest. I don't know if you've given a lot of thought to the survival of the fittest, but what it says is those animals which are fit are the ones that survive, and survivability can be defined as having fitness. Another way of looking at this logically is something like this. Deafness is the principal cause of the loss of hearing. You see, this is a tautology. It really said nothing. It simply said the fit survive, and the survivor defined is the fit. Nonetheless, this was incorporated in with this idea of overproduction, that somehow if you were more fit, you would win the battle, you'd be the meanest animal in the forest or whatever. Now we've redefined that a bit. Today we talk about differential reproduction. We say it's not a question of how mean or big or anything you are, it's how many offspring you leave. If you leave more, relatively more offspring, then that's what selection is really working with. And finally, because he had no concept of genetics, he thought in terms of the inheritance of favorable characteristics. That is, if an organism really wanted something bad enough, it sort of got it by desire or practice or whatever. The giraffe, Lamarckian idea of stretching your neck, and it would get longer and longer through effort by somehow passing on this acquired trait to offspring, something that I think we know is not true today. Well, Darwin's book sold out quickly. In a matter of days, the first edition was sold out. And it didn't sell out to scientists. It largely sold out to a lay audience that was very eager for it. This was the Industrial Revolution. Man was really ripe for the idea that we can justify our trouncing on other people and running over the top of them, if indeed we are the meanest animal in the forest. And so the great industrial magnates and much of the economic thinking of the time fit in quite nicely with the idea of a survival of fittest mentality. Nonetheless, it was an immensely popular book. Variation and natural selection, as I mentioned, is Darwin's main idea. Darwin saw absolutely no limit to this. By the way, the whole idea of natural selection came from a man named Edward Blyth, who had published his ideas a year before Darwin's publication of The Origin of Species, and had laid out completely the whole concept of natural selection, which he did not see as a means of evolution, but as a means of preserving the stability of a species. Edward Blyth argued that, look, if a species was made in a perfectly fixed manner and couldn't deviate left or right, it wouldn't survive. That indeed the species has to have a certain amount of lability, rather longer hair or shorter hair, or longer legs or shorter legs, or more body fat or less. that this range of variation is essential for survival in a varying environment, and that far from producing new organisms, it preserves the stability of the species itself. So, two very different approaches to the same idea. Nonetheless, Edward Blyth had come up with the idea approximately 24 years before Darwin and published it shortly before Darwin. What was Darwin's motive? Was he just simply a pure scientist whose mind was like the fresh driven snow on which only facts could be imprinted? I think a lot of us would like to think that, right? You and I are like this, it's the other people who would. Okay, Darwin's motive was contemplated on by Dr. George Grinnell, who was an authority on Darwin. And he said in an issue of Penzi, May 11th, 1983, that, and I quote, "I have done a great deal of work on Darwin, and I can say with some assurance that Darwin also did not derive his theory from nature, but rather superimposed a certain philosophical worldview on nature, and then spent 20 years trying to gather facts to make it stick." What were Darwin's religious views? I mean, we've all heard. I mean, the man was trained in theology primarily. I mean, not a bench-trained scientist by any stretch of the imagination. He learned a great deal of science from practical experience, and he was a good observer, not a particularly good writer, if you've ever read Origin of Species. Very few people have, by the way, and there's a good reason for that. Try it sometime. In his own autobiography, written primarily for the benefit of his children, he said, and I quote, "I had gradually come by this time to see that the Old Testament, from its manifestly false history of the world, was no more to be trusted than the sacred books of the Hindus or the beliefs of the barbarian. I gradually came to disbelieve in Christianity as a divine revelation." Also in his autobiography, he told his children that the study of evolution and what he perceived as the laws of nature made the miracles of the Bible unbelievable. Specifically, this is what he said, and I quote, "Thus disbelief crept over me at a very slow rate, but was at last complete. The rate was so slow that I felt no distress and have never since doubted, even for a single second, that my conclusion was correct. I can indeed hardly see how anyone ought to wish Christianity to be true." To the moment of his death, it would appear Darwin did not change his mind, despite the rather apocryphal tale that circulates that Lady Hope or whoever was at his bedside and got his last minute confession of faith as someone sung hymns in the adjacent room. This is a very touching story. Regrettably, it's not true. What about evolution today? Those of you, if there are anyone, who would like to combine some way an evolutionary concept with a creation concept, what does an evolutionist say about this? Are they in favor? Yes, at times they encourage you, if you really must have a God, have one. Your God can be the creator by using evolution. Everything's fine. Everything, you won't have to be embarrassed when you're among scientists and be worried about having your reputation questioned. You'll be a proper scientist when you're there, and when you're in the church, you'll be a creationist and you'll be fine there. In other words, you needn't suffer any abuse on either side. Let's look carefully at what some of the major spokesmen of evolution have to say. I can think of no more major spokesman for evolution than Carl Sagan, followed closely by the Harvard evolutionist Stephen Jay Gould. About a year or so ago, they were on the Phil Donahue show, who has some interest in evolution himself, having written a book called Man the Animal, which pretty well sums up the book if you haven't read it. Let me just quote for you exactly from a transcript which I purchased of that show what Sagan had to say. See if some of these ideas are familiar. "The universe is infinitely old. Since the universe is infinitely old, there is no question of where it came from or the origin of matter. It's always here. At the very beginning is this enormous explosion which sent the precursors of the galaxies flying out from each other. It happened about 15 billion years ago. You must imagine merely elementary particles, not even hydrogen atoms yet. Although lots of hydrogen atoms happen right after that. Cooling off, the universe gets darker. Atoms combine to form molecules, little lumps form, and eventually we get bunches of atoms of such large scale that stars are formed. Condensing out of this great set of clouds of gas and dust is the Milky Way. What is remarkable is that the Earth condenses out. The origin of life happens like a shot. Why? Because we can see the earliest life forms there going back all the way to the origin of the Earth. One of the problems of evolution nowadays is they think they see evidence for life just as early as the fossil record can go. It's traced back so far that from the time that the Earth could have possibly cooled, according to the evolutionary scenario, you have the better part of a long weekend to get life going. Sagan then goes on to show this cartoon. Have you seen it? It was in Cosmos. It's about a minute long. There's a Bach partita playing in the background on the harpsichord, and in this cartoon you can see this blob on the screen start going, and the arms come out and the legs come out, and finally, you know, through the fish, amphibians, the reptiles, the mammals, and then da-da, at precisely 60 seconds as the harpsichord comes to an end, man. And he showed this on the Phil Donahue Show, and the audience applauded and applauded. You know, I thought, why did they do this? Was this the best piece of animation they'd ever seen in their life? No, you know why they applauded? In 60 seconds, they had seen the entire evolution from a slime mold to man. And why? Carl Sagan, no less, told them, with a Bach partita. Then Phil Donahue has some questions. They wanted to talk about evolution of man and what have you, and Sagan says this first of all. He says, what you'll see in this cartoon, beginning as a collection of molecules, the first cell, all of this, of course, happening in the sea. By the way, nobody believes this happened in the sea anymore. The evolution of invertebrate forms, you know, forms without backbones, then fishy eyes that have backbones, amphibians crawling onto the land, and then the more or less familiar sequence which leads to us. So that was his summary. Then Phil Donahue comes in, he says, before we show that, I wanted a basic evolutionary concept. When the drought came and the water level went down, a lot of the life in that pond died. Some of it, however, over millions of years, apparently in an evolutionary way, developed amphibious capabilities. And then Sagan answers, yes, if you live in a little pond which dries up and there is a bigger pond nearby which hasn't dried up, by the way, if this gets too technical for you, stop me. If you live in a little pond and there's a bigger pond nearby that hasn't dried up, and by accident you're able to move your fins so that you can sort of flop into the next pond, you have a good chance of surviving, which your contemporaries who don't have a flopping fin capability don't have. So the guys who could move in this way survive. I'm reading it just the way it was said by a very distinguished scientist in the Phil Donahue Show to an intelligent group of laymen. It ought to suffice for you as well. Okay. Then Donahue says, he's getting very excited about all this, he says, the more forms of life that flop, the more floppers we got, and the longer they were able to flop, right? Sagan says, that's right, we came from the floppers. Then Donahue says, until pretty soon the floppers had legs to move, and then we stood up, huh? And Sagan responds, yeah, that's a direct quote, yeah. And then Donahue, obviously carried away by the spirit of all this, says, so that we could use our hands with instruments that we... And then Sagan interrupts, you know, Donahue's getting ahead of the story. He says, yeah, yeah, except that it's much later, and also so that it isn't that any creature said, well, it's time I stand up now, or I guess I'll flop, or I guess I'll develop lungs so that I can breathe the atmosphere. It is, to the best of our knowledge, the sequence of random mutations of which only a tiny few turned out to be useful, and a vast preponderance turned out to be of no help whatever. What does he mean by a tiny percentage of mutations would be useful? It's been estimated that there would be probably no more than 1 in 1,000 mutations that could be considered favorable in any sense of the word. It would then take approximately 1 million animals to get 2, in quotes, favorable mutations to impinge on the same animal. It's been estimated it would take at least 1 million successful dumb luck mutations to put together a complex living organism. And so at the rate at which mutations are known to occur, if the present is the key to the past, right, analogy, then we can say that to come up with 1 million fortunate mutations, you'd have to deal with a population of 1,000 to the millionth power organisms. How many is that? What you do is you draw a 1 and then add sufficient zeros that it fills 500 pages of something the size of the Encyclopedia Britannica. That would be the number of mutations you'd have to produce to come up with something that had this successful combination that we could call, say, maybe a living organism. There's a lot of ways to put it together wrong. Can you imagine that? Take your TV apart, put it back together again randomly. Lots of ways to do it wrong. You'd be surprised at how small a wrong thing can kill the whole organism. If evolution had given you your entire body, heart, blood, everything, brain, the whole nine yards, and if I just held back one little thing, if you just let me hold back one protein, evolution would never go any further. Let me have methemoglobin reductase, and you are a dead man. You won't get the time to experiment with this particular protein. If the whole of evolution are reduced to nothing but coming up with this one protein, that's it. When you got it, you've got everything. You couldn't accomplish it in anything remotely like the evolutionary time scale. Forget about billions and millions of years. You need Hubble times. You need to go into dimensions that nobody even talks about within the context of evolution. I'll go further than that. 6 days compared to 6 billion years is so trivial that it doesn't make a lot of difference which you believe in if you're talking about the time required for evolution to occur. The difference is trivial, even if you're only talking about the evolution of one protein, assuming you needed a particular protein. Evolutionists say, this is no problem. Evolution isn't trying to make any particular protein. It's just doing its thing. It's just throwing out things. Well, let's build a machine that way. Let's each of us imagine a part, weird little things, gears with two teeth on one side and one on the other, and let's throw them together and try to make a machine. To get a beautifully integrated and functional machine, at some point you do need specific parts. At some point you do need methemoglobin reductase or succinic dehydrogenase or something else, and without it, you're dead. So, I digress. The point is that Sagan has said that we need these dumb luck mutations. Then Donahue comes back and says, so most of life's evolution didn't work. And Sagan says this, he said, yes, and this is the most important thing I'm going to tell you all day, so if you haven't been listening too well, pick it up right now. Sagan says, yes, evolution in that sense is very inefficient. Lots of deaths in order to get us where we are now. The secret of evolution is time and death. If you ever wonder what the machine of evolution is, think of death. Without death, there can be no evolution. You have to get rid of the literally universes full of ill-constructed, unsuitable, defective organisms that would come from any mechanism depending upon random change in natural selection. Not only that, what on earth would you call natural selection before you ever got a cell? And by the time you get to a cell, you've already got 90% of the genetic inventory of the cell. What's left for evolution? I mean, just to have a cell be alive and exist takes the greater preponderance of all the genetic inventory of the cell. Now, if you're going to worry whether it's going to be a muscle cell or a blood cell, I mean, that's all peripheral. We're just trying to get something alive and running as a cell. What's left for evolution? So, yes, evolution is very inefficient. It results in massive death. Deaths that would be countless up until we come to man. Can you imagine the total number of dead and dying organisms it took to go from the first thing we could call alive until we got to the first thing we could call Homo sapiens? Would you like to calculate how many deaths are involved along the way? Trillions would be far too small a word. And then what does the Lord say to man once he does appear? You can see the tree over there? Don't eat of it. If you do, you'll surely die. The Lord would have to have been putting Adam on. You would surely die. Death got him where he was, according to evolution. He wouldn't be there if death were not an integral part of life. I recently attended a funeral for a friend who died, and I gather it was one of the few times he found his way into a church. And the pastor did not once mention the word sin, not once. But he said of death, he talked to the children of this man, and he said, I know you want to know what is the answer to death. He says, I'll be honest with you. He says, the one thing I can promise you, children of this, you know, deceased man, I'll be honest with you. He says, I don't know. He says, all I can tell you is that death is an integral part of life, that the Lord created it that way, and that's it. So look at the bright side, huh? My friends, if you accept anything remotely like evolution, anything remotely like it, you have to have death precede the fall. You negate in one fell swoop the whole need of a Savior. Now, perhaps I go too far. Is this really true? I think it is. And I think that many atheists have said the same thing. It's interesting. Sometimes you have to go to an atheist to really get some insight. One atheist is a fellow who publishes quite frequently in Madeline Murray O'Hare's The American Atheist. And in a little tract that was published by them recently, they talked about those theologians who accept evolution as the way God created. Liberal theologians. And this is what the atheist had to say. They are anxious to bring in gods which do not create, control, or know anything, and which are completely powerless, futile intangibilities. His God, that is the liberal theologian who's made his peace with evolution, his God serves no purpose that he will define, so it cannot be attacked but only denied. Evidently, then, religion has learned something from the attacks of us atheists. It has learned to be non-specific. But we must point out that this is only an attempt to preserve the notion of God after the substance has been destroyed. Lacking any separate function, such as being creator of the universe, the idea of God is completely to no purpose. The atheists understand this full well. I have to wonder about some theologians. Somebody, Luther Sunderland, recently wrote a book called Darwin's Enigma. And in this book, he makes the claim that the denominational seminary schools of virtually every major Christian denomination either directly or indirectly support the evolutionary paradigm. I hope he's overstated the case. I don't think he's badly overstated the case. I regret that this is true to some extent. A few years ago, I was asked by Wendell Byrd, who is the chief counsel in the famous creation evolution cases that have gone on in Arkansas and now in Louisiana, if I would participate and try to help thrust creation in the public schools. And I told him, no, I wouldn't, that I thought it was futile to try to get the public schools to teach something that the churches in this country wouldn't allow and that the Sunday schools wouldn't allow. Think of it. You could actually, if these laws were passed that the creationists want, you could have the public schools actually teaching things that would greatly upset a lot of Sunday school teachers and pastors and preachers. They have made the peace of evolution. Some say, well, but it's not so bad. You need to keep evolution or science in its category over here. You need to keep religion in its category over here. And as long as each stay in their own domain, they can get along just fine. You know what happens. Pretty soon somebody has to cross over, don't they? Somebody has to cross over. To give you an idea of what can happen, just recently there was a big meeting at MIT, Massachusetts Institute of Technology, actually back in 1981. It was reported in Science Digest in November of 1981 in an article called Visions of a New Faith. This was a group of theologians under the auspices of the World Council of Churches and scientists, mostly evolutionists, who got together and wanted to look at whether religion was relevant for the new age that we've finally reached. Specifically, they said, and I quote from the article, "Can religion established before Copernicus, Darwin, Freud, and Einstein see us through the future? Do we need a new way to worship?" Many of the evolutionists there agreed, yes, we need a new way to worship. Do I have to tell you what the new way is based on? Is it necessary? It shouldn't be. If you can't guess, I'll let you know. There was a fellow there by the name of Burho, who was apparently a fairly well-known theologian. He won the Templeton Award for Progress in Religion. He's a professor at Meadville Theological School in Chicago. And they said of Burho in this article that he thinks the revitalization of religion will come from an especially rich source. I quote, modern evolutionary theory. So the rascals aren't staying in their own camp after all, huh? They do have designs. Why not? Evolution was defined by Huxley as being the whole of reality. Does religion fall in the realm of reality? If so, it's a small part of evolution. If you look at Sagan's cosmic calendar, have you seen this thing? It's supposed to show the whole time scale of the universe played out as though it occurred within a year, and then giving you the relative time in days and months for each event. Do you know where religion came in? Be about the last nanosecond on that cosmic calendar as the neuronal complexity that was developing in the mind of Homo sapiens got to the point where it could come up with ideas, well, I don't know, pick a term, Jehovah. And it developed a religion. Religion itself is a product of evolution, according to the evolutionists. Of course, how else? It doesn't transcend evolution, it is a product, a very late one. Lightning struck rather close to a primate, perhaps, or maybe to an Australopithecine, and it jumped away, and first it worshipped the lightning. And then when the rain came, it worshipped the rain. When the sun came out, it worshipped the sun, and finally it concocted other names, Jehovah, what have you. One of the things they tried to analyze at this meeting is what is the actual scientific basis for religion, I mean structurally, biologically, neuronally, in the brain. I'm tempted to say, and can it be cured? They felt that religion must have some selective value, though they were rather hard-pressed to get to the bottom of that. And someone said that he had now localized the religious center, as it were, of the brain. A man by the name of D'Aquilli, a neurophysiologist, he said that he formulated a neurological description of what traditional religion calls the intuitive perception of God. So we've got this thing down to a science now, for the benefit of you theologians. Such religious experiences seem to be a product of the functioning of the parietal occipital region of the non-dominant right side of the brain. We've got you under the microscope. We are analyzing you and your religion and how it evolved in the minds of men. So that if you want to join our evolutionary camp, remember, we've got the whole of reality and you got a little piece, which we are looking at under the microscope. Well, I could go into many other things. I could talk about what has now happened in the schools, the effect of evolutionism on so many things. How we view man has such a profound effect on how we look at social studies, how we look at philosophy, how we look at ethics, how we look at psychiatry and psychology. It has a profound and pervasive effect throughout our whole body and throughout our whole minds. It can't be any other way. I have seen so many students over the years who've been so greatly troubled by the concept of an impersonal universe, a godless one. Just last week, a student came into the lab to interview me for student newspaper. There are not many of us around Washington University, certainly not creationists. Perhaps not really great numbers of Bible-believing Christians, though there I have to be careful to think I'm the only knee that hasn't bowed to Baal. Nonetheless, I'm sufficiently unusual. I was the subject of an interview for a student newspaper. And this student says, look, going to the area of neurobiology and everything, he says, I basically hung up all my religious views. He says, I come from a conservative Jewish family. And he says, today, he says, I'll tell you the truth. He told me, my religion is science. His religion is science. And he admitted it right up front. I can't urge you too much as pastors to be very, very cautious about how much credibility you give to the sorts of speculations that go on under the name of evolution. I cannot urge you too much. If this is a problem for you, and I hope it's not a problem for too many, think of the implications of evolution. Think if it really is as compatible with the biblical account of creation as some say it is. Just go down a list. Make a list for yourself as I did yesterday before coming here. What about the mechanism of the origin of all things? Evolution says it's impersonal and natural. Creation says it's personal and supernatural. What about time? Evolution says that it's still incomplete after 10 billion years. Creation said it was finished in 6 days. I have trouble with the 6 days, by the way, and I'll admit at times I have trouble taking it literally. I mean, why the Lord would dilly-dally for 6 whole days doing something he could do in no time at all has been an immense burden to me. I mean, you ever hear of fast miracles and slow miracles? I'll tell you the truth. This is speculation now. I'm not making this a doctrine. The only reason I can think of why the Lord created 6 days and rest in the seventh is to establish a pattern for a work week. You realize a week is the only unit of time that every society deals with that has no relationship to the movement of stars or planets or anything. It is an absolutely arbitrary figure. You know, we know what a day is based on and a month and what have you, but a week, it doesn't even fit evenly into many months. Nonetheless, I'm speculating there, and it's the very thing I sometimes criticize evolutionists for doing too much of, huh? Okay. What is the eternal? That's another question. Matter and energy is eternal to the evolution, thus no creator is required. In creation, God is eternal and the creator of all things, including time, matter, and energy. What about the order? We often hear, yes, but the Bible basically has the same order of events as the evolutionist does. You just have to work in a few extra days and months and years, everything comes out all right. That's not true. Let's take a look. Just a few examples will suffice. In evolution, marine animals appear before land plants. In creation, land plants are created before marine animals. They can't both be true. In evolution, the sun appears long before land plants and is indeed essential for their origin. In creation, the Lord had the audacity, and I think it was intentional, to create plants that depend on the sun before the sun. If that doesn't lay to rest all of our speculation, I don't know what does. Then we can go on to other things. Birds, according to evolution, arose from terrestrial reptiles. According to creation, birds were created before any terrestrial animals, including the terrestrial reptiles. Evolution says each organism arises from an ancestor as a result of fortuitous chance mutations and gradual improvement. Creation says each kind of living thing was created finished and perfect, and all were judged by God to be good, and we know when he says something is good, it's very, very good indeed. We're not good. Not after the fall. Evolution says living organisms do not reproduce after their kind in the long run. Creation says living organisms reproduce after their kind, long or short run. What about man's meaning and purpose? This is fundamental to the issue. Evolution says man has evolved from the animals, including ape-like ancestors. Creation says man has been especially created in the image of God and has no ancestral relationship with the animals. Adam had dominion over all the animals, and after naming them, he was still alone and found no suitable mate. And so in Genesis 2, verse 20, we read, "But for Adam there was not found a helper comparable to him." And to come up with female Homo sapiens after male Homo sapiens is an idea so totally foreign to evolution that not even the most ambitious of higher critics could possibly concoct a way out of that one, except to run roughshod over the simple words of Scripture. It even goes on to what is our primary purpose. In evolution, man's primary purpose in life does not necessarily have anything to do with God. To creation, man was created for a very special relationship with God. In Ephesians chapter 2, verse 10, we read, "For we are all his workmanship, created in Christ Jesus for good works, which God prepared beforehand that we should walk in them." Even our very works are a gift of God, as you all know. Evolution says that the very teachings of Christianity, like all religions, are merely an expression of neuronal complexity and are themselves a product of evolution and thus always changing. Creation says simply in John chapter 1, verse 1, "In the beginning was the Word, and the Word was with God, and the Word was God." And in Malachi chapter 3, 6, "I am the Lord, I do not change, the same yesterday, today, and tomorrow." Why do people believe in evolution? Is it a simple case that we've got two kinds of people out there? We've got the not-so-bright people who believe in evolution, and then us terribly clever people who figured out that it doesn't work. Don't you think that for a moment. We just had, 70 Nobel laureates all line up, lock arms, dance the can-can, and collectively say evolution's the only answer. I'm going to come up here and say all these Nobel laureates are wrong. Yeah, I'll do that. I'll do that. By the way, they didn't allow certain Nobel laureates to join in. Who's the fellow from Stanford who believes in inheritance of certain racial characteristics and what have you. He wasn't allowed in. So they had their own little in fights as to who they wanted to parade in front, endorsing. They all wanted to, but certain ones were kept out. Probably understandable. In any event, why do some people then believe it? It has nothing to do with how intelligent they are. In fact, I'll go so far as to say, on the average, I suspect that the evolutionists and the virtual unbelievers in this world, on the average, may be a little higher on standardized intelligence tests than us Christians, huh? I find that an acceptable possibility, at least. No, it has nothing to do with intelligence. It has everything to do with the bias that we bring to the issue. Most of my friends who are evolutionists begin with the assumption there is no God. If there is no God, now explain everything in terms of no creator. Explain the origin of Ford automobiles if you assume there are no designers and builders of Ford automobiles. Come up with all possibilities. Self-assembly is all there is if there's no designer and builder. The reason people do not believe in God as creator is rather interesting, because they choose not to believe it knowing better. Now that puts a person in a really interesting position. I've had occasion to be involved in a few creation evolution debates. And as you know, creationists usually win these debates. When I'm talking to somebody who adheres tenaciously to evolution, I know in my mind, because the Lord has told me, they know just as well as I know that God is creator. How do I know that? My friends, read Romans chapter 1, verses 18 and following. I'm sure these words are familiar to you already. For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who suppress the truth. It doesn't say they don't know it. It says they suppress it. Who suppress the truth and unrighteousness, because what may be known of God is manifest in them, for God has shown it to them. For since the creation of the world, his invisible attributes are clearly seen, being understood by the things which are made, even his eternal power and Godhead, so that they are without excuse. Because although they knew God, they did not glorify him as God, nor were thankful, but became futile in their thoughts. I think speculation is another word appropriate there. And their foolish hearts were darkened, professing to be wise, they had become fools. I think that says it all. And with that, I'll simply conclude and entertain any questions if there's time to raise them at this time. I don't have all the answers, but I'll at least give some thought to your questions. Are there any? Yes. Yeah. My understanding of Scripture, and I could be wrong in this, is that Adam and Eve did not eat animals. Is this true? I mean, the eating of animals came later. And I suspect animal death became later. The Bible seems to have a rather different view of plants than it does of animals, and it sort of categorizes them into sort of two different kinds of life. I don't think there can be any question. There was clearly plant death prior to the fall, but I would propose that plants, unlike what the evolutionists would tell us, that we share common origin with plants, though nobody ventures exactly how that could have occurred. I think the Bible places plants in a distinctly different category, but you'd have to look at the words of Scripture to really see the details there. Yes. The question is, has my belief in creation created problems with colleagues? The answer is, I guess, yes and no. By and large, my colleagues have really been wonderful, and I sometimes feel guilty that I don't get persecuted a little more. You know? They've really all been very dear to me, and they know exactly how I feel. I've shared my thoughts with most of them. There are no holes punched, or no punches barred. We've really been through this with most of my friends. And I teach my course. My students like me. My colleagues mostly like me. I do my research and try to be a good academic citizen as far as that goes. I believe in a creator. And usually I'm not on the defensive, I'm on the offensive. And yet I try to do it in a way that I don't buttonhole people. I wouldn't have been here if I were not invited. I can't say as I really suffered. On the other hand, I'm sure there are people who think that this is really a perhaps one of just a few terrible aberrations in me. One of my friends, a student in the medical school, told me that one of the distinguished professors, who is an evolutionist there, said that, yes, that's one thing they don't understand about Dave Menton. He has this curious aberration. So if that's all it takes to be a fool for Christ, it's really pretty small so far. I may have to pay more. Who knows what the Lord has in mind. Thus far, he's preserved me, just like Daniel in the lion's den and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego in the fiery furnace. I really haven't been burned yet. Yes?
Isn't the real tension, the sort of tension between revealed knowledge and scientific knowledge, that you can posit God because he has been revealed to you? The fact that his mind, that science can be created, a simple human mind, is very limited in what it can understand, namely only that which is part of the created cosmos. I don't think one can necessarily call science for drawing conclusions that are sometimes that that is a presupposition that the function we have to bring in outside is in the field.
Yes, I basically agree with you. Say science can't posit God. On the other hand, I think we should be careful. If we're dealing with empirical science, remember, empirical science really began with good, solid Christian men and women. I mean, we're talking about all of the great leaders of science: Virchow, the father of modern pathology; Newton, Pasteur. I mean, the giants of science. These were Christian men and women, and they defined science as what we would call empirical science today. If I can make the analogy to Ford cars again, we can work on a Ford car, we can repair it, and we can understand how it works and how it's put together, and we can treat it as a purely materialistic machine, right? No problem with all of that. But when we ask, how did we come to have Ford cars in the first place, there are only really two different possibilities. Either that car was designed intentionally by a designer who wanted it the way it is, though it may have been damaged subsequently, or Fords are a spontaneous self-assembly mechanism that exists in nature. And I think where scientists run into the trouble is when they leave the realm of empirical science, they enter the realm of historical science, and then having entered the realm of historical science, they try to apply the criteria of empirical science. They say, in empirical science, we don't allow supernatural intervention. We can understand how Fords run purely in a mechanical way. See? Likening the body to the Ford. But if they ask, how did we come to have Fords? And then a priori, they say, I want to stick with a purely materialistic explanation of Fords that doesn't involve a designer, then I think they are doing a disservice to science. So that's kind of where I would draw the line. Empirical science is a different kettle of fish than historical science, and you can't use the criteria of historical science. Yes. No, I certainly generally agree with that. Any other? Yes. You'd have to be very specific. I mean, I hear this so much, and I must say, if you're going to raise this particular matter, you must be precisely specific now. You must tell me what it is about the evolutionary paradigm that makes the exploration for oil impossible if you're a creationist and only work if you're an evolutionist. Means what specifically is the person who's exploring for oil doing or using as an assumption that is foreign to creation, literal creation? No, I think you've got to be specific, though. I mean, you've raised something. You're suggesting that here is one area, a tangible area, where the creationist would simply fall flat on his face. He could not find oil because the assumptions he brings to Earth geology would not include the necessary wherewithal to find oil. I know nothing about the exploration for oil that in any way, shape, or form requires evolutionary assumptions. If I'm wrong, what I need now is a specific point where I'm wrong. Yes. I don't know. I'd have to hear a specific, to say you're wrong, I'd have to hear what it is specifically. I mean, oil, I could make a case that creation really helps in the exploration for oil. For example, for one thing, creationists have recently discovered that oil can be formed rather quickly. It doesn't take millions of years. It can actually be produced in the laboratory given certain conditions of pressure and temperature, which can actually be achieved. So oil can be formed quickly. Coal, we know, is the process which occurs when immense layers of thick foliage